And I was asked by the B.H. Roberts Society to moderate this. John Ashton organized the panel, but he's next door on the dealing with sex. and so asked me to take his position. We know what his priorities are between sex and truth here. So let me just give you some background, because this is the first of four panel presentations that the B.H. Roberts Society has planned. For those of you who do not know, the Society was established in 1980, dedicated to the discussion of timely issues within Mormonism. And during the next academic year, they plan to sponsor four sessions, this being the first, dealing with the concept of truth. Do we always know what the truth is? Can it change over time, according to circumstances, or according to our understanding? Are there situations when telling less than the whole truth is justified? And finally, what are the consequences, good or bad, of telling what a church member perceives to be the truth? The other sessions will be first telling the truth about our history, and then telling the truth about our scriptures, and then telling the truth to our families. So that you know, the next session will be Thursday, October 17th at 7:30. That's telling the truth about our history at the U of U Behavioral Science Auditorium. So I hope that you can join us for the other sessions. We have three panelists today. Let me introduce them. First is William Wiesner, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Utah. Bill tells us he's most proud of the several distinguished teaching awards he's received over the years. And when I met him yesterday, I had a definite flashback. In my own life, actually, he is most noted for being one of the few professors during my undergraduate years who actually piqued my interest in a topic enough that I actually read the assigned material and studied for the exams.
And now you have a PhD.
And now I have a PhD. So I remember those discussions in the I think it was Intellectual Traditions of the West in my freshman or sophomore year. His current philosophical interests have turned to issues of religious truth and truth in general. He's written some papers on the problem of self-deception and moral responsibility in a pluralistic world. And we've invited him to kind of give the a basis for us to start talking about the issue of truth. After him, we will hear from Paul Richards the next, whether that's right or left, I don't know. But anyway, he's the director of the public communications at Brigham Young University, a former print journalist, worked for the San Diego Tribune and Deseret News, and he's worked for 14 years as what he calls a spear catcher. And I think it is also notable to say about Paul that he seems to be trusted and liked by people who usually don't like public relations people. I should also note that the smartest thing he's done this year is to marry Mary Stovall. Ross Peterson will conclude the panel. Ross is a professor of history at the University of at Utah State University, and known to us as primarily as the co-editor of Dialogue. He is also the chair of Utah Humanities Council, the director of the Mountain West Center for Regional Studies, and he administers the David and Beatrice Evans Biography Award. He is here because he, as editor of Dialogue, he has faced issues of truth and truth-telling on a very personal level and can respond to that. Now, John asked me to say something briefly about this topic, and I just want to do so with one little incident and then quickly turn it over to our panel just to try and set the stage. A decade ago, I participated in a gathering of women. It was a several-day excursion to Nauvoo and a celebration of the founding of the Relief Society. As a budding young graduate student, I took the opportunity, what all good sociologists do, and design a questionnaire and collect data from the women in attendance. The Equal Rights Amendment was on its last leg, but was on the minds of everyone present. Since the group had a decidedly feminist focus to it, there was a sense in the group that everyone there was de facto a supporter of the Equal Rights Amendment. One of the questions on my questionnaire asked the respondents to indicate whether they were for, against, or unsure about the Equal Rights Amendment. When I returned home and began to tally the response, I was surprised to find that in this group of women, where everyone thought that everyone was for the ERA, one-third indicated they were for it, one-third were against it, and one-third were unsure. As I reported these findings informally among those who had attended, one by one admitted, "I thought I was the only one with questions." As we think about truth and truth-telling, I suggest that we keep in mind how difficult it sometimes is to actually, quote, know truth. Institutions like families or churches or multinational conglomerates encourage individuals in one way or another to collude together in creating images that are, quote, not true. I find that Mormons are sometimes more forgiving of other institutions than they are of their own. We simply have very high expectations for our church. But one of the first principles I learned as a sociologist is that organizations can only be as perfect as the people who are in them. Let me now turn the time over to the panelists.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm delighted to be here today, and I also appreciate the B.H. Roberts Society for asking me to appear on the panel. I'm very supportive of the kind of reflective effort that Sunstone tends to engage in their yearly activities. In some sense, I suppose it's presumptuous for me to be on this panel in that I'm not a Mormon, I'm not a historian by training. When Fred Esplin called me up, I told him I would, and in thinking about it, it might have something to do with the fact that I have written a good bit related to the topic of self-deception. And it's quite possible that I'm self-deceived about my own limitations and felt that I could say something that was worth taking seriously. So let me launch into a short paper that I call The Duty to Tell the Truth and Truth in History. In the complex history of the Western moral and religious traditions, we find an endorsement and defense of the moral view that telling the truth is morally good and that lying is morally wrong. We also find a commitment to the value of honesty and trust between persons. Most philosophers and theologians who speak within and across these traditions acknowledge that one can justify or excuse lying or withholding the truth in some circumstances. Such justifications may or may not succeed depending on the morally relevant context in which the dishonesty occurs. The Greek classical tradition that begins with Plato and Aristotle defends the virtue of honesty. In the 18th century Kantian tradition, the duty and obligation to tell the truth is grounded in the categorical imperative and pure reason. In the late 18th and 19th century utilitarian tradition, various writers defend the virtue of honesty and the duty to tell the truth by arguing that honesty and truth-telling will result in the greatest happiness over the long run. In the 20th century, the various forms of consequentialism and non-consequentialism in ethical theory also recognize this moral good. The intuitionists, existentialists, communitarians, libertarians, each in their own way and for their own meta-ethical reason, accept this prima facie good. In the Hebrew, Christian, and Islamic traditions, we also find an acceptance of the value of honesty, the importance of trust between persons, and the value of truth-telling. Theologians within these traditions engage in an ongoing debate about when and why it might be justifiable to lie or to withhold the truth in some circumstances. Historians take the duty to attempt to tell the truth about the past as an evaluative commitment that constitutes, in part, what it is to do historical research. If one disavows this constitutive commitment, one is no longer doing history. One may distort history and use the fictional account of the past to advance other ends. In doing so, one is not doing historical research or attempting to offer a reliable historical account of the past. In developing his construction and defense of the ideal state in the Republic, Plato attempts to justify the use of a fictional account of the past as a strategy to implement the realization of his ideal state. In the ideal state, he thinks that only the philosopher kings should rule. All the members of the state should perform those tasks to which they are best suited, given their unequal natures and abilities. Only the philosopher kings have knowledge and virtue in the relevant respects, and because of this special expertise, they are entitled to rule the state. The other members of the state are relegated to positions in which they are denied the right to participate in political decision-making. In Book 10 of the Republic, he rationalizes and stabilizes this ideal meritocracy by constructing the myth of the medals. According to this myth, God fashioned each person in the pre-existence out of different metals. Those fashioned by gold were destined to rule the state. Those fashioned by silver were to function as guardians of the state. And those fashioned with bronze and iron were to function as farmers and craftsmen. From his elitist perspective, he justifies telling this lie about the medals to make the members of the community satisfied in fulfilling their different roles and function in the ideal state. He thinks it is justifiable for the state to coerce each person to do what they are best able to do, even if they have contrary desires. The myth of the medals will help assure that they will not have such desires. Each person will believe that they are destined by God to do what they do. We find another classical fictionalized account of the past in Dostoevsky's powerful work, The Brothers Karamazov. In one section called The Grand Inquisitor, a cardinal in the hierarchy of the Catholic Church in 16th century Spanish Seville during the Spanish Inquisition confronts the returned Christ and attempts to justify the fact that the Church has decided to reinterpret his teachings. The Grand Inquisitor attempts to justify the right of the church hierarchy to lie to the masses about the history of Christianity in order to promote their happiness, security, and unreflective commitment. According to this fictionalized account, the masses are, quote, afraid of freedom and responsibility, end quote. They prefer peace and even death to freedom and responsibility in the knowledge of good and evil, close quote. The Church provides mystery, miracles, and authority in exchange for each member's freedom and responsibility. Both Plato and Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor lie to the masses in order to promote what they take to be a greater good. We have the classic case in which those who control the power within institutional hierarchies justify lying on benevolent paternalistic grounds. Neither Plato nor Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor is doing history or attempting to tell the truth about the past. Each writer is constructing a fictionalized distortion of the past to rationalize the promotion of institutional and personal goods in the present. Governments, institutional bureaucracies, politicians may choose to construct specious stories about the past to advance what they take to be goods in the present. The historian, qua historian, tries to tell the truth about the past by constructing the most reliable, descriptive, interpretive, and explanatory accounts of what occurred in the past in light of the best available evidence. These descriptions, interpretations, and explanation are put forth tentatively in light of available evidence, and they are always open to revision in light of newly discovered evidence. The historian makes truth claims about the past and justifies these claims in light of the evidence about the past. These claims are true or false depending on what has or has not occurred in the past. Some of these claims are strongly supported by the available evidence, some less strongly supported, and some are mere hypotheses for which there is no reliable evidence available. Even the most strongly supported beliefs about the past are not immune from criticism in light of new evidence. The method of historical inquiry is fallibilistic in C.S. Peirce's use of this notion. The historian does not give us the truth, with a capital T, about the final and complete past that we now understand in its totality. Quite the contrary, the historian offers tentative stories, narratives, and accounts that might be rendered unjustified in light of future discoveries. Even the historian who is trying to be honest in his or her accounts of the past is highly susceptible to the dangers of self-deception and willful ignorance. If the religious historian is strongly motivated to maintain certain beliefs about certain historical events that are central to one's theological and religious perspective, one may be prone to self-deception and willful ignorance. The tendency to deceive oneself about the reliability of one's account is not unique to the religious historian. It is a serious risk for any historian who is strongly motivated to believe that certain events have occurred. Some historians, sociologists, political scientists, economists, and anthropologists may bring a particular theoretical perspective to their understanding of the past. Because of this theoretical commitment, they may be motivated to maintain beliefs about the past that coincide with their theory and to avoid facts that conflict with their theory. One attempts to deceive oneself about one's account of the past if one avoids facts that are inconsistent with the beliefs one is strongly motivated to maintain, or if one avoids doubts that might prompt further inquiry into historical possibilities that could threaten one's belief in those events that one is strongly motivated to believe. One engages in willful ignorance if one chooses to refuse to look for, examine, and evaluate evidence that might call into question one's preferred beliefs. The desire to accept a certain account of the past can corrupt even the sincere historian's attempt to provide a reliable account. In a paper prepared for delivery at the 1984 annual meeting of the Mormon History Association, Lewis Midgley and Gary Novak attacked the New Mormon historians and claimed that all historical inquiry is grounded in fundamental assumptions that must be taken as a matter of fact. Faith, excuse me. mm-hmm. That sort of stuck in my craw, didn't it? As a matter of faith. They criticize assumption of writers like Sterling and McMurrin and James Clayton, and they take the view that the religious historian operates with fundamental assumptions about the existence of supernatural explanations about the past that play a role in the descriptions, interpretations, and explanations in Mormon history. They caution the new historians that this new history may not be any more reliable than the old history. More importantly, if the naturalistic accounts are mistaken in questioning the supernatural foundations of Mormonism, this type of historical account can undermine the beliefs that are central to the practicing Mormon. For example, the supernaturalist accepts on faith the belief that the Book of Mormon provides a reliable account of the history of the Nephites and the Lamanites. If and when McMurrin and others call this assumption into question, according to Midgley and Novak, they are opting for a reductive naturalistic account that calls into question this fundamental supernaturalistic assumption. They have opted for a different fundamental assumption that must be taken as a matter of faith. Midgley and Novak affirm the role of the divine in the intervention of Mormon history, and McMurrin and others are skeptical about these supernatural explanations. From the perspective of Midgley and Novak, there is no reason to think the fundamental assumptions of the naturalistic historian are any better than the supernaturalistic assumptions of the church historian. In the end, one adopts fundamental assumptions as a matter of faith. Misusing the writings of various writings in the hermeneutical tradition, Midgley and Novak characterize the dispute as a fundamental dispute that cannot be resolved since fundamental assumptions are immune from criticism. Contrary to Midgley and Novak, this is not in principle an irresolvable dispute grounded in fundamental assumptions that are taken as a matter of faith. This is a substantive historical disagreement about whether the historical evidence supports the truth of the supernatural accounts of the role of the divine intervention in Mormon history. Contrary to Midgley and Novak, all historians operate with what they call naturalistic assumptions. Both the naturalist and supernaturalist agree that there was a Joseph Smith who claimed to be a prophet and who functioned as the first Mormon leader, claimed to translate the Book of Mormon from the Golden Plates, etc. The supernaturalist assumes much of what the naturalist assumes. Perhaps if there were strong, independent anthropological and historical evidence supporting the historical account in the Book of Mormon, some of this skepticism would dissipate. Many historians and anthropologists think that the Book of Mormon is not a reliable account of the history of the Nephites and Lamanites because it is not supported by independent historical and anthropological evidence. They not only doubt parts of the story, they doubt that the Nephites or the Lamanites existed. Many non-Christians have a similar skepticism about the historical account of the divinity of Christ that is largely grounded in the Gospel of Mark. The skeptic believes that the church historian's account of the past is mistaken because there is no credible evidence to support the reliability of the account. As a historian, she will admit that there may be future evidence that might call her skeptical belief into question. Ironically, if one adopts the Midgley-Novak approach, Mormonism can fare no better than naturalism, since each perspective is grounded in assumptions that cannot be argued about. It is not obvious that this type of relativism regarding historical truth should encourage the faithful. Any given piece of historical research is contextual, relative, and grounded in at least some beliefs about the past, which are the assumption on which the historical inquiry is dependent. Contrary to Novak and Midgley, there are no fundamental beliefs about the past that are immune from criticisms. The beliefs that operate as assumptions in the historian's pursuit of further inquiry are beliefs that the historian accepts because they are supported by historical evidence, or at least the historian thinks they are supported by historical evidence. The open-minded historian is always willing to argue about whether the evidence is sufficient, even for these beliefs that ground further inquiry in a particular context. In spite of their appeal to and misuse of the new hermeneutics, Midgley and Novak erect a historical relativistic foundationalism in which historical knowledge is erected on fundamental assumptions about the past which are immune from criticism and taken as a matter of faith. This type of epistemological foundationalism is exactly the type of view that Bernstein, Rorty, Gadamer, and others in the hermeneutical school are criticized. Now, maybe this is just more of a debate among philosophers, but I mention this because they're using these philosophers to support their view, and I'm arguing that the view of these philosophers is just the opposite of what they take it to be. The new hermeneutists are critical of both epistemological foundationalism and ontological essentialism. It is always evidence about the past that places restraints on the historical researcher. There is the danger that the Midgley-Novak position will result in a kind of historical idealism in which constructions of the past are grounded in assumptions that render all historical accounts of the past ultimately tied to assumptions that are not supported by historical evidence and not related to what actually took place in the past. Historians do disagree about accounts of the past, but in principle they are realists about the past and operate with the assumption that such disputes are in principle resolvable by discovering more about what happened. In some cases, when there are disagreements about the strength of evidence or about what counts as evidence, they agree to disagree in light of the available evidence. They continue to conduct inquiry, with the hope that new evidence will shed light on the issue in the future. The Midgley-Novak position regarding the nature of historical inquiry is short-sighted, even in light of the purposes it is designed to serve. And those purposes are preserving and enhancing the beliefs of the faithful. Over the long run, the church could be harmed if there is one history for the faithful and another history for the professional historian. Should the church historians exclude an account of the dialectic between the defenders of orthodoxy and those who want to modify or reject orthodoxy, it runs the serious risk that it will be charged with refusing to tell the whole story. This debate between the Midgley-Novak position and that of the new Mormon historians is part of Mormon history. It would be unfortunate indeed if the church historians do not provide an account of this dispute and see it as part of their own Mormon history. The history of Mormonism is only one small part in the complex historical puzzle that is always incomplete. Even the metaphor of the puzzle is inadequate, since the shape of the pieces and the arrangement of the pieces can be altered in light of new historical discoveries. None of the shapes of the pieces are fixed in a way that pieces in a puzzle have a fixed shape. If we take the historian to be working with pieces of the puzzle that are fixed in shape, we run the risk of the type of foundationalism that we find in Midgley and Novak. If some of the historical pieces are excluded by some historians, other historians are likely to supply the missing pieces. In some cases, result in pieces with new shapes that result in a new puzzle. The new puzzle will have enough similarity with the old puzzle so that the historian can preserve some continuity in his or her account of the past. A reconstruction of the puzzle is something that the historian does in discovering new evidence. Such discoveries can lead one to dismiss some alleged evidence and to reassess old evidence in a new way. Unless there is a new wave of fascism, and I don't rule that out, no group of historians and no institutions over the long run can conceal the excluded pieces from the historical puzzle. This is a general point that applies to all institutions and persons who are committed unequivocally to a final, fixed, exclusive account of the past. The recent overblown surface dispute about political correctness conceals a deeper, more significant historical dispute between those who want to do exclusive history and those who want to do inclusive history. One's account of the past has implications for how one understands individual and social change in the present and the ways in which we assess the present strengths and weaknesses in our society. The historian who tries to do exclusive history will become an anachronism over the long run. Exclusive history does not stand the test of rational criticism in light of the available historical evidence. Over the long run, the tendency is for the historical account of the past to be more inclusive. When we view past attempts to exclude part of the past, we see the excluded pieces as part of a more inclusive account of the past. Future historians are likely to look on the debate between Midgley and Novak and the new historians in the same way. Thank you.
I have to say to Marie that if I had my choice, I'd prefer sex too, compared to the discussion here. I need to give you a little background. My presentation will be different than Bill's, but we tie in some ways. I was raised as a military brat, and I remember hearing my father and seeing my father and his associates talk about the general and what an SOB he was and shaking their boots. And then as a little kid, I'd see these officers get together, and on one occasion we're at our house, and became stupidly drunk, and I watched one of them, the chief SOB, fall into the swimming pool. And I thought, this just doesn't fit. And from that, I don't know if it's in my nature or what, I've been suspicious of authority and organizations ever since. I became a reporter, worked on the San Diego Union, and I saw this as an idealistic way of getting to the truth, working with the truth, exposing the truth when people don't want to have it exposed. And I remember several occasions there, one in particular where I was assigned one afternoon to go down, you know, I was working for the San Diego Union, and interview a 16-year-old kid who had killed his mother with a baseball bat. And as I sat in that room, I thought, it's true he did this, and obviously he needs help, but what does the public need to know about this kid? And what my paper wanted for this interview was not what the public needed to know, but what they thought the public wanted to know. And I started thinking, if you're going to do anything worthwhile in life, you had better do something that means something and not just feeding the public. And that's where I started distrusting the public. So I've gained a great distrust for the public as well. When I later worked for the Deseret News, I remember one particular incident, two incidents. One, I was working for the Deseret News in 1971 when Ernest L. Wilkinson resigned. And I remember him announcing his resignation and saying in that afternoon, he says, "Well, a reporter called me this morning and wanted to know," I think these are the words, I can't, the media, I'm surprised. This reporter wanted to know if I was retiring. Well, I told him I'm not retiring. But I'm here this afternoon, well, it was later in that morning, to tell you that I'm resigning, but I'm not retiring. And I think he meant that in a sense, now as I look at it, to say he didn't believe in retirement. But as a reporter at the time, I took it to mean I really put something over on the media. Boy, did I fool them, and am I ever clever. And I resented it as a reporter, and I resented it because I said that does not, or I felt that did not represent an institution well, to have somebody come right out and say, "I fooled you, ha, ha, ha." So that didn't sit well with me. And I thought, if I ever got in a position like that, I certainly wouldn't want to say something like that. And then the last incident that I will paint here, Paul Swenson and I were working on the Deseret News at the time of the Colville Tabernacle. We came in, and we were assigned to go out and do various things. My assignment was to go over to the church office building and interview the people who were protesting out in front. And this was, I think you remember, the morning when we all woke up and everything is already gone. And I got my quotes, and Paul got his. We had a whole team of reporters, some up in Colville, putting this whole thing together. We came back, and I sat next to Maxine Martz. I don't know if you remember her byline, but she was a non-member, a non-LDS person, very good person, a veteran reporter of many years. And it was her assignment as the rewrite person to bring all this together. We were supposed to put all this together, and then she takes it, digests it, and it takes a great talent to do this, and start putting a story together from all the different sources. And it wasn't long before the word came down that the Deseret News was not going to run. The whole tabernacle had been taken down that day. It was a bitter pill to swallow. The KSL, because of federal communications law, could not be held back like that, so KSL could do what it wanted to do, and everybody else in town could do what they wanted to do. And I sat next to Maxine, and I heard her say, and I was pretty idealistic at the time, she says, "I don't know why I work for this chicken outfit." And I didn't have an answer. I simply did not have an answer. Well, since that time, I've had an interesting interaction with the truth.
I get a little warm.
I have always loved the character in All the King's Men, Robert Penn Warren. I mean, I have his work, Jack Burden, if you're familiar with him. He was the reporter who went to work for the governor and watched all this from behind the scenes. And I have taken great delight in being behind the scenes and watching all these interactions going on ever since that time. Little did I know at the time that Wilkinson made his statement that 7 or 8 years later I would be in a position to talk to the media. And I went into that position with an attitude of wanting to tell the truth. I really sincerely, honestly did, because I saw so many instances where it was not told, and I wanted it to be told. In All the King's Men by Robert Penn Warren, Jack Burden says, "The end of man is knowledge, but there's one thing he can't know. He can't know whether knowledge will save him or kill him. He will be killed, all right, but can't know whether he is killed because of the knowledge which he has got or because of the knowledge which he hasn't got and which, if he had it, would save him. There's the cold in your stomach, but you open the envelope. You have to open the envelope, for the end of man is to know." Now remember that. The end of man and woman is to know, because that's where truth is going to be. And what I'm going to tell you next is cynical, and I hope you'll understand that, but it doesn't mean that I've given up. We are told we are supposed to tell the whole truth. I don't have the guts to do it, but I'd like to take my shirt off and address you topless today and see how that makes you feel. You would be uncomfortable, most of you. If we want the whole truth, why don't we all go around naked? In fact, our society dresses up. The very things we do all day long are covering up something. So we really don't have this for the whole truth. We really don't want the whole truth, nor should we necessarily get the whole truth. Just as my example of the 16-year-old who killed his mother with a baseball bat, I don't know how much people need to know about that. That kid needed help, and I saw other cases like that with child abuse and so on. What good does it do to tell the public about all the gory details when maybe there's something else that could be done to help? So, we start out in our church and in our university and in our culture, in our country, and we talk of truth. We talk of Santa Claus. And that's a myth. It's a good myth. It does the job. But where would we be if we all held on to the myth of Santa Claus into our middle age or older? It would wreak havoc on the economy. It would be a very difficult thing to pull off. We are told in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not bear false witness. Moses was told to choose men of truth. In the quadruple combination, there are some 82 references to truth, and they're pretty straightforward. Tell the truth, be honest, come out with the truth. And then this is good. I don't know how often we listen to this, but a scout is trustworthy. A scout tells the truth. He keeps his promises. Honesty is part of his code of conduct. People can depend upon him. And it goes on with all the others. I don't know how many scouts are truthful. And I don't know how many of you who have had much experience with a scout would know that, or would say that a scout is clean, or that a scout is reverent, or that a scout is brave, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty. We all have these things that we have as goals to go for, but in reality, they're not there. They simply are not there. They are goals. Now, when we fall short of those goals, we ask for derision. We don't do that so much with the scouts, but I see that in the church, and I see it at BYU. There is a great propensity for organizations to be concerned about image, to talk to the lowest common denominator. And when we don't reach that, then everybody's ready to jump on board and say, ha, ha, ha. I think you've seen Time magazine. We've become a nation of complainers and peckers. People who are self-righteous prigs. And that's where the contrast comes. And it sets up for a great controversy, a great tension. And in my work, there's tension. My new wife of 2 months, Mary, says, be sure to tell him that you've taken up flying as a means of relaxation. Flying is not relaxing, but it is more relaxing than my job. Out of this, there has come a great loss of trust. And I think you can all understand that in our world. We are losing trust in each other. Whom can you trust? Like Pilate says, what is truth? The old cynic, what is truth? Even here in Utah recently, we've come to suspect the infallibility of the Republican Party. We have learned to distrust government. Case in point, our government I grew up with, the post office, all these things that were great and wonderful. I was in Germany on my mission, and I could hardly wait to get back to where things made sense and people did things right and the colors were right and so on. And then I find out in my own backyard the government has been down testing in Nevada without any regard for the people there, and I went down and did a story on that. And to hear those people talk about watching, taking kids out to, out of their schools to watch those clouds come over, rends your heart. And then to see the, I get emotional about this. To see the blatant manipulative movies that they were putting out at the time just tears your heart out. We've had a number of things that have changed. Everything changes all the time. That's one thing we've got to face up to. Two Minnesota papers are being sued because they reveal their sources. What's that going to do to journalism if people tell something and then have their sources revealed? Now, whom can you trust? Can you trust those who are after the truth? No, they want the story. Well, that's the way it goes nowadays. It makes a better story. I was talking to Janet Swenson just before we started here. She says, I don't like to talk to the media anymore. And she's been married to a journalist all her life. And she says, I don't like to talk to them anymore because of the misquotes. I don't trust them. They manipulate. NBC's Today show aired a shoddy program on the shoddy products of their manufacturer. This was some time ago. Now, do you know who owns NBC? GE. Do you know what shoddy products weren't mentioned on that show? So, it gets to be... It's hard not to be cynical. I can remember working in San Diego on the police beat and a young green behind the ears reporter and seeing this reporter down at the police night sarcastic and bitter. And I thought, well, that's what happens because you get to see life as it really is and you don't have all this fluff and pitch and so on. Life as it really is. And I've tried not to become that way. I had inside information on Garnbaum and the apple orchard incident. You remember the 60 Minutes piece that they did on it? My gosh. And I talked to people who gave those people information, but they had their agenda. And boy, did they do a hatchet job on the church. And then I thought, wait a minute. Here are the media that are supposed to be telling the truth, and then this happens. I got interviewed recently when we had a fiasco over the motion picture studio at BYU. Reporter came, talked to me. I gave him a lot of information. I learned later that the reporter went and took the tape of my interview, sat for 3 hours in Kurt Vreeken's home, and the photographer went to sleep. This went on so long. And let Kurt Vreeken, who was the opposing viewer there, edit that tape and respond to my questions. I don't mind a good tete-a-tete and a good interaction, but boy, I start mistrusting when that kind of thing happens. I really mistrust. Well, I think you can get what I'm after. I can cite instance after instance. Bob Byers, a very well-known public relations person at Stanford, got fired. He's well off now. He wanted to tell the truth about the president's divorce and marriage because he believed in truth. Well, he got fired. And you can see what's happened to Stanford since then, not because of Bob's firing, but just kind of the general thing of the cover-up. He wanted it out. I've come to believe, as Bill Gnott says, ignorance replicates itself at the speed of light, while enlightenment is a very slow process. Reporters don't tell it all, and I'm just setting a scene here. Don't jump to conclusions. One of our own channel stations here. 1 minute. Okay. Well, this is too long of a story to go on. Let me just.
You can tell 1 minute.
No.
Sorry, that took too long.
Okay, tell one more story.
Go ahead, Beth.
Yeah.
Well, a channel here in town got a story on a car dealer. The car dealer was pulling some shenanigans in involving finances, and that story was pulled. And that same channel comes down, and I don't get me wrong on this, but after a while, when I'm trying to give out truth, and this happens with reporters, and acts like there are some self-righteous type of people who are going to expose everything in the world, and I know they've done this, which would have benefited humankind, but they pulled the story, I become cynical. And I think you can understand why. Well, let me just jump to some conclusion. Some truths I believe in. One is, we're pretty gullible as a people. Joseph Smith said it best, and it still pertains today, but there has been a great difficulty in getting anything into the heads of this generation. It has been like splitting hemlock knots with a corn dodger for a wedge and a pumpkin for a beetle. Even the saints are slow to understand. We make up myths to back up what we want to believe. We don't want the truth, necessarily. We don't want to pay the price for truth. And we do feed on myths. And it boggles my mind to hear some of the things that people come up with in relationship to BYU and in relationship to the culture that are pure and simple myth. A couple of other, if I can have just a couple of minutes, let me finish up here. A couple of truths about organizations. This ties in with what Bill was saying. Organizations don't like to change. And they give you the impression, this I have from John Sorensen, who's spent years and years of studying anthropology. They tried desperately to point out that they have never changed. They don't want to have history out because it'll show there have been changes. There's a consistency. If you can say, we've been the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. The irony of that is that any organization that survives has to change in order to survive. And that's one glimmer of hope that I have, is that there will always be change. In my personal life, I'm pleased that the Arizona Republic did what it did. I'm pleased that Lynn Packer got the story on Elder Dunn out, Paul Dunn, even though there was a conflict over that at BYU. The whole story of that will be told someday. I'm disappointed that the Utah media had that story for several years and could not use it or would not use it until it broke outside. The Arizona Republic broke the story. The Arizona Republic did the thing on the finances. The media in Utah could not touch it. And I have to say, even Sunstone had the story and decided not to use it. I don't know for what reason. But what I'm saying is, don't condemn the church or BYU for being self-righteous or priggish or for not telling the whole truth. In the first place, I've dealt with things personally where the whole truth involving some faculty members would not serve anybody well. And the whole truth needs to be digested appropriately. And if you want it just for gossip's sake and for myth's sake, I don't think you ought to have it. If you really want it for the truth, then go for it, but you pay a heavy price. I think we are oversensitive as a people. We need a sense of humor. We should stop taking everything so blasted seriously and get on with life, and we'll be much better off. So, to finish off, you have to open the envelope, and that's my hope, that even though some people don't want the truth, they are satisfied with myths. I hope there is enough of a critical mass in people like you who have to open the envelope, for the end of man and the end of woman is to know. Thank you. see if I could see through those glasses. This is an interesting challenge for me. About 30 years ago this autumn, I confronted really for the first time historical truth. I knew an awful lot of answers as a missionary, and I was sent up to East Lansing, Michigan, where Michigan State was, and one day in our vigor, we ran into a home where the individual there was more than thrilled to let us in, which should have told us something. And they took us right into his study. And as we began our spiel, I was going number two. I looked around at his books. And I'd been on a mission long enough to know better, but inside I said to myself, holy shit, we're in trouble. Because we'd barely gotten through the Joseph Smith story, and he started to ask us about the Kirtland Anti-Banking Society. Somehow that blew by me in seminary. And then he started to ask us about polygamy in Nauvoo in the early days, and started to tell things that we had not exactly been instructed in our pat answers about more women than men and all this kind of stuff. And then he talked about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. He was the Western historian at Michigan State University. And we went out of there with bowed heads, tails between our legs, and I told my companion, we're not doing another thing until we go to the library. And we went to the library, and we flipped a coin, and I read No Man Knows My History, and he read Juanita Brooks's Mountain Meadows Massacre. We considered this good proselyting for and study for our reports, and just read, and it had a profound impact on me. Number one, I stayed on and finished. I did change my rationale and found various and sundry devious ways to avoid those issues. But my professional training as a historian, I'm really guided, I think, by three things. One, a quotation I read many, many years ago, a book by Walter Lippmann called Public Opinion, in which he said something to the effect that there are pictures in our heads and there is a real world. People behave according to their pictures in their heads, not to the real world. And Thomas Bailey, the Stanford historian, said it really more succinctly when he said, what people believe to be true is often more important than what is true. And the other quotation, I think, is especially appropriate. It comes from Mr. Jefferson, who in 1800, when he ran for the presidency against John Adams in one of the weirdest elections ever held because of the original Constitution before they conceived of parties. By the way, I'm fairly cheered by the opportunities of the Democrats. As long as we can get Steve Studdard to run every Republican campaign, anyway, we won't go into that. But this is, I'm really trying hard to be nice. And, anyway, Jefferson had just been blasted in the press in 1800. People were worried about their Bibles. They thought he was an atheist. This is when they first broke the story about Sally Hennings and whether or not Jefferson had fathered slave children. And Jefferson made a famous quote. I think he wrote it. Jefferson didn't like to speak ever. And it was something to the effect that if I had my choice between free speech without government or government without free speech, I would choose the former. And he also said, in light of that campaign, that error of opinion can be tolerated as long as truth has an opportunity to prevail.
And in the training and in my pursuit of my career, I've tried to remember those kind of conflicting things. Because when you do historical research, when you try to find primary sources and find out really why something took place, not just the who, what, where, when, but for historians the most important question is why, that sometimes you really can't know. You can find all the evidence you can, but you can't get into that picture in the head. It's difficult to find out why people acted, what was going on in their mind at that time, if they have not left a written record. It's also important, I think, to try to determine what the who believed, when, where, and why. Thus, search into the past makes living in a complex contemporary institutional world very difficult. The last thing religious institutions and governmental institutions and many others need to explain is why they do things. Prior discussions, debates, research, and analysis need not be cited or explained. Historians of contemporary institutions, religion in this case, Mormonism maybe, are increasingly frustrated by the irony of an organization that admonishes the writing of journals, diaries, personal histories, family histories, yet advises that these journals, diaries, personal histories, and family histories try to emphasize faith-promoting things. Every day of life is not necessarily faith-promoting. It is difficult sometimes because the institution maintains a fairly closed, not only archive, but access to the information about how and why decisions are made. And often the decisions that affect the lives of numbers of people. A good historian should try to apply the same type of inquiry looking for religious truth as they do historical truth, or history about religious truth. It is still imperative to find out why. Now, there's one other point I want to mention as kind of a guiding thing in my own life in this search. In an entirely different context, in 1950, William Faulkner received the Nobel Prize for Literature for what he had written in 1950. I guess he got the award in 1951. But among the things he said in his acceptance speech is that the basis of human emotions is fear. And then he talked really about atomic fear and McCarthyism and the things that were taking place at that time. But he said that there is a danger that a fear so long sustained that it can consume us. That's probably about the only thing Faulkner ever wrote that I can understand. I like the Reavers. I think some days I can understand Light in August. All that other crap just... Anyway. Are we then afraid of truth? Applying Faulkner to the other criteria. Do we fear that inquiry, scholarship, opinions, probing can lead to disillusionment, dissatisfaction, despair, and loss of faith? One of the things that creates a particular problem in the study of religions, and especially religions that profess truth, is that there's really a difference between a church that professes truth and other institutions. See, that there's not a true government. There's not really a true state university. There's not really a true church university. Nor is there a true church football team. But they don't profess that. Oh, some people believe it and act like it. But a church can profess that they are true. Indeed, if it is true, can it handle the truth about itself? if it or its leaders choose to be less than honest, to protect the church. And going back to what Bill said about some of the earliest writers on how to protect institutions, is that wrong or right? Can you undo history? We constantly rewrite it in view of change, in view of new sources, in view of new interpretations, but you can't undo certain things. I've often thought, and I thought of it for the very first time 30 years ago, when after reading about the Anti-Kirtland Banking Society and what happened internally in the church when people found out that, in effect, they'd invested in this man and his institution and they'd lost it, and what happened in Nauvoo when they were having whisperings about polygamy and splits among the faithful, and often it was those that had been in that became the most bitter enemies. You know, what if they'd have told the truth? Or did they know the truth? Or did they dare? You know, in the time in which they lived. You know, the same thing is true really in Utah and the whole situation about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. The whole polygamy thing is very, very intriguing to me. You know, after the Anti-Bigamy Act and then the Edmunds Act and then the Edmunds Tucker Act, you have these people who you know, have an article of faith about obeying and sustaining the law, but have chosen to fight it in the courts, and even when losing in the courts, continue to fight it. In kind of a, not necessarily terroristic underground, but certainly an underground situation. I mean, my family used to delight in telling the story about my brother Hiram. They had these places where they'd hide the men, and the marshals would come and they'd ask the children, you know, where's your dad? Who's your dad? Where's your mother? Who's your mother? Well, how'd you get here? Well, I greased my butt and slid down a rainbow, you know, and the family used to delight in that kind of deception. But the whole polygamy thing for many years caused really an interesting historical deception in order maybe to survive. The long-term effects it had on those children without fathers, and the effects on many of the women and that, you know, historians are really dealing with and working with. But it is, in a way, an interesting historical deception in which there is almost a kind of aura of pride that they were able to pull this off. I thought about something yesterday when one of the most intriguing things to me, a year ago I read a biography of Rudger Clausen written by his two grandsons. It's an interesting biography in many, many ways on what it leaves out and what it doesn't include, but I've anguished over how this man, as a member of the Council of the Twelve Apostles, could sit in judgment of Matthias Cowley for still believing in plural marriage and still performing them when the very year Matthias Cowley had sealed Rudger Clausen to Pearl Udall. And I've you know, I wonder how you deal with that, you know, with that kind of deceit. And I was thinking yesterday, when John Sillitoe was talking about Richard Lyman in that case, that maybe one of the reasons they waited so long for the Council of the Twelve to act was that the Clausens and the Smoots and the ones that really still believed had to die. I don't know. But that has a long-term effect to me on how you deal with honesty in a religious setting. Does that then affect the good that these people do? And we had people get up yesterday and talk about the fantastic speeches on chastity that Richard Lyman gave. Does the end justify the means? I don't know. It's very, very difficult. I think, you know, the church survived these events. I remember another real awakening I had. And this was a very, very tough thing in my life, because I was a senior in college, been accepted to a number of graduate schools, waiting to see where I got money. And I was a finalist for a particular national fellowship that if I got it, it would take care of everything through my PhD. And the interviewer flew in to the Hotel Newhouse remember we're down on 4th South, and I guess it was State. And I remember I came down in January from Logan, and it was a blizzard. It was a vicious blizzard, and it was about a week after our first child was born. And I drove down there, got down there, and this was a professor from Columbia. And he basically, I shot my chance on the first question, because it had to do with the church's policy relative to blacks. It was 1965. I was only trying to develop an awareness and understanding. I remember just shortly before being totally moved, not so much by the I Have a Dream speech of Martin Luther King, but by his letter from the Birmingham jail, which I think historically will go down as one of the great documents. And that's one of the reasons you don't have to fear history, is if you read all the biographies of King, let alone Lyndon Johnson. You know, they tell you more about historians sometimes than history. But the first question he asked me was, how could I rationalize that? If I was going to be a humanist and a scholar and go out and teach, how could I have a belief and hold fast to an organization that denied humanity to a portion of the people? Mistake. I was honest. I said, I don't believe that. And then I was ripped to shreds. And I was really young. I wasn't very bright. Still not. I suffer from diarrhea of the vocal cords. And consequently, I never really handled it. And I've thought about it for 26 years. Not only did it cost me a lot of money, I mean, I was trying to be honest. My mind wasn't set. It's a very confusing thing. And it still, you know, caused me some difficulty for 13 years after. Now, what do you do in a contemporary society outside of a historian where you're confronted with a situation where you're asked to talk about truth or how you perceive truth and how it can lead to problems? Let me give you one example. A few years ago, for a number of years, Idaho tried to pass a lottery. It has brought a great amount of fame to La Tienda in Cache Valley, the little store across the border, where last year Utahns contributed about $1.4 million to Idaho education by buying lottery tickets at La Tienda. I don't know if they buy the beer there, but it's my colleagues tell me it's got the greatest collection in the West, but nevertheless, this was a very, very hot issue. It had been passed previously and then kind of postponed until they had a statewide referendum. The legislature had passed it. Just a few days, in fact, the Friday before the election, I'd gone up into Idaho to watch my nephew play football and sat there with a lot of the teachers in the schools who were Mormon, a couple of them bishops, who were irate. They were very upset. And I listened, and what they said was that the church had sent out a letter from the area presidencies to all the regional reps how to organize the people against the lottery by using ward stakes, regional boundaries, and just changing the titles of the area of the regional reps, the stake presidents, and the bishops. And that even said they could go out and collect money and have the home teachers do it. I thought that's kind of interesting. I can't remember when it was, but shortly thereafter, the diarrhea got going in the vocal cords because I got a phone call from a dang reporter, the Idaho Daily Statesman. And he said, "You've written a lot on Idaho history," which I had. I'd written a history. And he read me the letter from the area presidency. He said, "Is this precedented?" And I said, "Well, maybe in some areas it may have been done with the ERA. I'm not aware. But in Idaho, I don't think it has been done. But I want to tell you, see, in this one, if I'd been smart, I just said, I don't think it's been done." But see, you're primed for 50 minutes as a lecture. And he was calling, and there was a pause, so I had to keep talking, see, so they'd keep taking notes so you don't lose the class. And I said, well, my study of Idaho history would tell me that if the non-Mormons of Idaho saw that letter, the lottery will win. Because the non-Mormons and a pretty good percentage of the Mormons don't ever want Salt Lake City to control them politically. They published my comments in the letter. And the lottery won. For which later I found out that I was to blame. In another interview in a different situation. There we go. Finally, I think one of the main questions that I've had to ask, and I've said this before, I've chosen by design as a historian to not really do Mormon history. But the question I have to ask relative to truth and is whether or not truth is individual or institutional. And going back to what I said about what people think is true, I've come to the conclusion that the strength of an institution, including a religion, and this is my opinion, is because of the strength and the commitment of the individual members, not necessarily of the institution itself, although, or not institutional decisions. I still ask the questions. I still wonder why. You know, I still want to know why, you know, certain things change. You have, you know, in contemporary time, in your own lifetime, because you're not sure now, see, that you'd ever be able to look at First Presidency minutes or diaries or journals and see if there was a debate around changing the priesthood. See if there was a debate around two-piece garments. I thought that would be one of the greatest debates, one of the greatest revolutions and revelations, and no one ever talks about it. But it, you couldn't have had the block system without it. Anyway, you know, people just couldn't have sat 3 hours. I better shut
it. You're warming up here. Give him another 10 minutes.
Well, in my final view, there's no substitute for the truth.
Okay, we have about 15 minutes for questions from the audience. So I'd like to encourage anyone who'd like to ask our panelists some questions to do so at this point. Now, let's repeat this question then.
No comment.
Do you want to say that again so we're cut
He's off? Wondering if any institution that, whatever it is, has anybody assigned as a public communications or public relations intends to tell the truth. There are some that don't. I would have to say my personal experience in working at BYU is that it does want to tell the truth, but doesn't want to be completely open in all cases because of the damage it may do. And institutions, as Bonarici says, cannot be made safe for people. And institutions will always start out with some noble goal and then end up having their goal as self-preservation. And that's where you may have the public communications, public relations people coming in as damage control. It's an unfortunate thing, but I think we've got to face facts. That is a rule. That, I believe, is a truth. All organizations have a certain pattern of acting. And as Ross says, the strength of the organizations will come from the individuals who are willing to speak out and say what they want. The organization itself will always go to the lowest common denominator, will always try to be safe. It's a tremendous responsibility to be talking about things when you don't know how that's going to come out. I would have to say BYU, in my experience, I've been there longer than I ever thought I would survive, because I have had a relationship where I have been a double agent trying to interpretate to the media what the administration is asking, and to the administration what the media wants to know, and trying to keep them from becoming paranoid every time a question is asked of them. It's a legitimate thing to ask some of these things, and the typical response for an organization is to go into shock mode, throw up the bridges, and my job, I have to say, has been one of great interest because I've had, I believe, some success in helping in facilitating that. But generally speaking, I see some public relations or public communications or public states types, people who are manipulating the public, who I think are there strictly to cover up.
Yeah.
I really got. I personally.
Paul,
yeah, she's asking about the Paul Dunn story and what Lynn Packer did. That was a very difficult one for me because I got burned. I got burned by a television station that didn't do its homework. I was trying to be very helpful, and all they needed was to come up with, well, here's a contradiction, and so Richards isn't telling the truth. I resent that. I did have a very healthy interaction with another reporter, whom I have a great deal of respect for, who wasn't out just to get a story to sell to the people, again, the gullible people, who took the time to find out quite a bit, and he came up closer than anybody else to what the real truth was on it, because he did take the time to ferret out and to come back and to act. But TV was just schlock job. I mean, they had to have a story. They had to have it quick. The little girl who came, shouldn't say it that way, but the young woman who came down was really thrilled because she was going to be on TV that night. Otherwise, she didn't want to come down to BYU and do this thing. I mean, it's all showbiz, and I have a great respect for those who really want the truth. But I have to place the blame partly on the public for accepting every little ripple that comes across the waves. We're not very discerning sometimes. I hope that answers your question.
No.
Yeah, I think I did. But now, you see, that gets into litigious. That's another thing you got to be careful about. And a thing that bothered me a little bit, I told the truth, but it was viewed as if I had gone too far from both sides. And threats of lawsuits and things like that, that scares you. And the university saying, well, you know, this really wasn't worth telling all that. Why did we? I botched it. I have to admit, I botched it because of the way some people handled it.
Could, as each of you respond, could you repeat the question?
See if I understand you correctly. I enjoyed these papers, by the way. It strikes me that what you're trying to get at is the idea that sometimes we may believe certain things that may, for other reasons, be false, but they somehow benefit us in various ways. That sometimes it may be a good thing to believe something, regardless of whether it's true or not, because it functions in our life in some way that's beneficial for us and perhaps for others. All men are created equal, or all persons are created equal, I suppose is a kind of evaluative notion, and I think the way most people construe it is it's a principle about equal with respect to rights. I don't think anybody thinks that people are necessarily equal with respect to all of their skills, talents, and abilities, but rather you believe that probably because you think that there are equal, that there's some important respects in which humans have equal rights, and you see that as a kind of evaluative principle that functions in some way to guide conduct so as to benefit people in the community. But that's a kind of evaluative belief. Remember, I was talking mostly about what the historian's trying to do in attempting to come to understand what took place in the past. I think I tried to indicate that there may be circumstances in which you can justify either lying or giving people false beliefs because somehow it will produce very good results for all kinds of people. And then there's also this idea that sometimes if we believe that we can succeed in certain ways, even if those beliefs are improbable, our believing it may help make it true, that beliefs can become self-fulfilling prophecies and so forth. But I think you've got to discuss all of these issues in particular context with respect to whatever the particular issue is and the relevant considerations. So I don't know. My own, perhaps my bias came through in indicating that I think it's very important for institutions to try to tell the truth and for persons to try to tell the truth. But I don't want to rule out the case where perhaps believing a number of false things about oneself or others can have very beneficial consequences for oneself and others, and maybe in some of those circumstances we'd want to say you're justified in holding those beliefs in terms of their benefits, even though they may be false. Truth about the world, if you're talking about truth about the world, you're talking about holding beliefs about the way things are in the world. I mean, if I believe there are people in the room, that's true if there are people in the room. And this has to do with matters of fact. If you're talking about interpretation or explanation, that's also connected with matters of fact. I mean, we believe that Kennedy was shot. We believe that Oswald shot Kennedy. We have a little bit more evidence for the first than the second. And then we might say we believe Oswald shot Kennedy alone. We have a little less evidence for that than the second and the first. And these are all sort of interpretations, descriptions and interpretations. Now we might say Oswald shot Kennedy alone because he was depressed and had a very low sense of self-esteem or was paid by somebody else. And now we've got an explanation.
As I recall the question you're asking, if I were asked to do to tell a lie, in essence, would I do so? I'd like to go back to what Bill just said. There's a fascinating publication on Orson Pratt's tracks, his discussions, and in one of them he talks about absolute truth and relative truth, or you call it situational ethic. He says there are some things we know we shouldn't kill each other. It's generally known we shouldn't commit adultery, and so on and so forth. But then he draws some other things. He says there's special truths. How many of us are supposed to take our sons out and sacrifice them like Abraham did? How many of us are supposed to go out and build an ark? So there are some special truths that come to us as individuals, and that's where the strength of the church is in the individual right to know, and in the individual's right to do. Not to be told what to do, but in the individual's right to do. If you want to carry that a little further, how many of us would go out and kill somebody, steal, lie, and kidnap based on what we know to be true, and yet we are very willing as a people to accept that because that's what Nephi did because God told him to do so. The danger in that is you have a Jim Jones who can manipulate people the same way, and all of a sudden you're off in some other realm. It's a very, very, this thing of truth is a very, very dangerous thing and very easy to fall apart on. Now, as to the question.